Drake and Lace. Love is wicked. The song reminds me of our nights of King of Prussia back in the day with Dave Charlie Kolima. Dave Charlie, I hope you're doing well in Canada. We need to do a reconnection. Let me know what's good. Let's catch up. You know, either you come down to the Berg or you make another trip up to Toronto, Canada. One of the best things about the trips to Toronto is, hey, there are Cuban cigars in Canada. It's legal to have Cuban cigars in Canada. What a guan, yeah? We're about to come up to the end of the reggae set, so don't go anywhere. Keep it locked right here on WRCT 88.3 FM. Also on Asha Radio Prime, broadcasting in Toronto, Canada, pretty much in Canada. Not forgetting Africa's hottest online radio station, Ma Walking Radio, broadcasting in Kenya, South Africa, Uganda, Zimbabwe, Ghana. Man, hey, hey, it's an online radio station. With Starlink, get your connection going, get entertainment going, all family friendly.
Girl, me want for you all, yo. Put me arms right around, yo. Girl, you give me the tightest hold me ever get in my life. Girl, me want for just squeeze, yo. Put me things all around, yo. Girl, you give me the tightest hold me ever get in my life. Mm-mm. Me ride them gems in your care. You take it anytime, anywhere. In all the square, so me no fear. And as a woman, I will be there. We want a girl, we can't wine for me. We want a girl, we can't take care of me. Let me feel it, let me feel it. Oh, me, I feel really squeeze it. Girl, me want for you all, yo. Put me arms right around, yo. Girl, you give me the tightest hold me ever get in my life. Girl, me just want to squeeze, yo. Put me things all around, yo. Girl, you give me the tightest hold me ever get in my life. Hold on, like a fast bike on the road, boom, 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 boom. Girl, on the back and see a boom, 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 boom. Give me the mag of one, the fat, kum, kum, kum. Me the play last one time, it come to kum, kum. Me out of control, I'm more fire, she want in her soul. She say more and more and still she grown. And still me multiply more, girl, me want to just hold, yeah. Put me arms right around, yeah. Girl, you give me the tightest hold me ever get in my life. Girl, me wifey just squeeze, yeah. Put me arms right around, yeah. Girl, you give me the tightest hold me ever get in my life. Squeeze, yeah. Around, yeah. Tightest hold me ever get in my life.
This is Law and Disorder. Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with the author of an alarming UN report titled Global Threats to Freedom of Expression Arising from the Conflict in Gaza. Our guest is Irene Khan, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of the Right to Freedom of Opinion and Expression.
We speak with Professor Emeritus from Purdue University, Bill Mullen, on Black resistance to fascism. Bill's written two books, We Charge Genocide, American Fascism and the Rule of Law, and The Black Anti-Fascist Tradition, Fighting Back from Anti-Lynching to Abolition. What Bill has to say is profound. We can't rely on anything but ourselves in the streets, demonstrating from day one if Trump is elected.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. On top of the devastating humanitarian crisis and the issues of genocide and violations of human rights in Gaza and the West Bank, there has been an unprecedented attack on freedom of the press.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT.org.
From KUT
and KUTX
Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
Up until when Bitcoin was created, everything on the internet was like infinite. Like you can infinitely create anything on the internet. They didn't have a way to like make it scarce. And so they finally figured out how to make data on the internet scarce through some complex system. And you can talk about it or not, but that invention was Bitcoin. So it was like, oh, okay, now we have a money where there's only going to be 21 units. It can't be copied, and the system can't be, or you know, it has yet to be hacked. And if you talk to anybody who's like a data person, and they look at the system, they go, yeah, this is basically, it has more computing power than every country, every, you know, company, and for it to be hacked, it would, it's basically just not possible. So now you have money that is super hard to produce, and that's how money evolves, right? The money evolves when it's the hardest to produce.
Philip Washington Jr., founder and CEO of Stonehill Wealth Management. Bitcoin is a form of digital currency that aims to eliminate the need for central authorities such as banks or governments. Instead, Bitcoin uses Chainlink's technology to support peer-to-peer transactions between users on a decentralized network. Each Bitcoin is a digital asset that can be stored at a cryptocurrency exchange or in a digital wallet. Each individual coin represents the value of Bitcoin's current price, but you can also own partial shares of each coin. Launched in 2009, Bitcoin was the first and remains the most valuable entrance in the emerging class of assets known as cryptocurrencies. According to an April 2021 survey by Ariel Investment and Charles Schwab, 11% of African Americans say cryptocurrency was their first investment. The corresponding number for white Americans was just 4%. I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Understanding Bitcoin with Philip Washington Jr. in Black America.
And so with Bitcoin is the hardest money. Mm-hmm. So once people go through the learning curve and understand it, they're going to first be attracted by the returns, and then they're going to do their research, and they're going to realize, oh, this is the hardest money to produce. Then it sucks in all the wealth over time. So it eats up the money that would have normally went into gold. It eats up the money that would have normally went into, like, people typically used to buy rental properties. Like, rich people bought rental properties because if you keep the money in the bank, it decreases in value over time. So you don't want to do that. So you're like, but I can put it in real estate, right? There, you know, that appreciates because there's a limited supply of real estate. And so they bought rental properties. Well, now you got a money where you don't have to maintain a rental property. You don't got to deal with renters. If the world shuts down, you don't got to worry about not getting rent. You can put the money into Bitcoin and transfer that wealth across the world, like, easy.
As a cryptocurrency, Bitcoin is designed to act as money and a form of payment outside the control of any one person, group, or institution. This removed the need for trusted third-party involvement in financial transactions. Bitcoin was introduced to the public in 2008 and has since become the most well-known and largest cryptocurrency in the world. Its popularity has inspired the development of many other cryptocurrencies. Investors and speculators became interested in Bitcoin as it grew in popularity. Between 2009 and 2017, cryptocurrency exchanges emerged that facilitate Bitcoin sales and purchases. Prices began to rise as demand slowly grew until 2017, when its price broke $1,000. By 2030, the global cryptocurrency market is projected to reach $1.6 trillion, signaling advancement in virtual banking systems and potential gains for investors. Within the African-American community, virtual currencies have symbolized to some degree freedom, even autonomy from a central banking system that for centuries have been subject to political decision-making. Recently in Black America spoke with Philip Washington Jr., founder and CEO of Stonehill Wealth Management.
Born and raised in Houston, Texas, went to school at UT San Antonio, lived there and worked there for a bit, and we made our way to Dallas, almost 15 years ago, and this is home now.
I understand. And what particularly sparked that interest to dabble in finance?
The short story is I didn't know what I wanted to do, and finance was just something that was super interesting to me because I didn't grow up with money. I didn't understand it. But when I learned about money, it in my mind, it represented freedom. I was like, oh, okay, I'm a free spirit, and this money thing can allow me to be free. So probably should learn it, study it, and then it became a profession.
And what led you to found Stonehill Wealth Management?
Part of the freedom, you know, I spent a decade selling products, you know, for a bigger company. And then once I figured I knew enough to try to sell my own money management services, it was time because I've always been driven by freedom. And, you know, when you sell it to somebody else, you have to sell, you know, their package stuff and their ideas. And I was like, oh, okay, I got my own ideas.
Now, we've had conversations before, but I want to bring that conversation to a larger audience. Talk to us about Bitcoin. What is Bitcoin?
Bitcoin. So the simple version of it, in a economy, you sort of have two main things that are just always evolving across time. You have like production, which is, you know, how do we produce things? How do we make things that people want? And that technology evolves, right? Everybody's talking about AI and all that kind of stuff. And so AI is the way to give people producing things superpowers, because we can produce more for cheaper. On the other end of the economy, if you talk about the two polarities, right, you have money, and that's also evolved. So in the beginning, well, you know, there's, you know, that's debatable, but like in the very early days, we would use seashells for money, and then that became easy to produce, and, you know, some countries use beads for money, and that's pretty easy to, you know, it was relatively easy to produce once Europeans brought ships to Africa and were able to, you know, get the material from different places that made it easier to produce. And then, you know, then we got gold, right? Because in order to get gold, you got to have a star blow up around you. And if you want to pull it out the ground, it costs a lot of energy. So that was relatively hard money to produce. So, you know, we built money systems around shipping gold around the world to settle up. And so that was the thing. And then we invented the telegraph. So that allowed us to move money around faster, and we used central banks to make the money relatively scarce and hard to produce, because you gave a monopoly to a group of people that can dictate how much money went into the system. And I'm giving background because money is going to be the technology of money evolves with the speed of the money and the scarcity of money. And those two combine gives you the next evolution of money, right? So we're in the paper money era where, you know, it was backed by, you know, central banks that can move it fast through telegraphs and computers. But in the age of the internet, and specifically when you have the invention of what's called like cryptography, which I don't want to go too nerd, but basically, like, you know how in the internet, like a picture, mm-hmm. You can have a picture on the internet, and that picture is like infinite, right? We can just create infinite copies of pictures on the internet. So up until when Bitcoin was created, everything on the internet was like infinite. Like, you can infinitely create anything on the internet. They didn't have a way to like make it scarce. And so they finally figured out how to make data on the internet scarce through some complex system, and we can talk about it or not, but that invention was Bitcoin. So it was like, oh, okay, now we have a money where there's only going to be 21 units. It can't be copied, and the system can't be, or, you know, it has yet to be hacked. And if you talk to anybody who's like a data person and they look at the system, they go, yeah, this is basically, it has more computing power than every country, you know, company. And for it to be hacked, it's basically just not possible. So now you have money that is super hard to produce, and that's how money evolves, right? The money evolves when it's the hardest to produce. And so that's what Bitcoin is. It's 21 million scarce, limited money that nobody can produce any more of, which is what wealthy people want to put their money in.
Now, when you talk about 21 units, what does that mean?
So a Bitcoin, right? So if you were to look at the system, you would say, all right, there's only going to be 21 million Bitcoins ever produced, ever available to be owned in the system. And if you want to change it to something that's even easier, we can say, you know, it's the equivalent of we live in Dallas, so you have like the University Park neighborhood, where it's the exclusive neighborhood. It's super expensive. All the billionaires live there. And it's so expensive because every rich person wants to live there, and every rich one wants to live there because it's a limited supply of homes, right? So there's only going to be so many homes ever in that neighborhood. So Bitcoin is just a unit of the 21 million. Now, each unit can be divided by 100 million subunits, and that's the whole conversation. But there's only going to be 21 million of those units.
Now, how have we got to the point where Bitcoin is on par, I guess, to some extent with gold, the dollar, home ownership, and stocks and bonds?
Yep. So part of the evolution of money. So I'll use AI as an example, so I don't go too nerdy into the Bitcoin realm, right? When you look at production, right? We said, okay, there was a point in time where we used horses to move us around in carriages, and then we invented technology, the motor, that would give us horsepower and like a little thing. And then that became the more efficient way to move around, right? And then we used to use people to do everything and move things in factories, and then we built machinery that can help the humans build the thing, right? And then same thing with computers. You know, we would have to do all the calculations in our head, and we built computers to do it faster. Now we have AI that can basically produce just about anything, and so it could do it cheaper, faster, for more production costs. And so now the winners are the ones who are learning to create things with AI to produce more, right? So evolution works that way when it comes to producing things. Now, going back to Bitcoin, the money evolution goes to the most scarce thing. And so you want to think in the mind of like rich people, and they're going, like rich people don't, they're like, I'm rich. I don't want to take risks, right? And the biggest risk to a rich person is the government and taxing your money away because they overspend on stupid wars and expansion or whatever. And when they can't tax anymore, they inflate the money, right? Because that's an easier way to tax, because they can just print more money to finance the wars, and that makes the value of your money worth less. Going back to the example of University Park in Dallas, let's say there's only, I don't know how many homes there are, let's say there's only 1,000 homes. Right, it's valuable because there'll only be 1,000 homes. If there could be 1,000 more homes printed and it becomes 2,000 homes, that chops the value of the property in half because you have more supply, right? Pushing up against the demand. So same thing with the money is when they just create money, which they have been doing perpetually for a long time, to pay for their stuff, it makes the value of your money worth less. And so rich people are going, I want to find the hardest money to produce, right? So on the production side, I want to find the cheapest way to produce the most things. On the money side, I want to find the hardest money to produce because it's going to store my value, right? One of them is going to create abundance. One of them is going to create scarcity. And you get in that balance, you have a society, meaning you have money that holds its value, and then everything that you're producing abundantly falls in value relative to that money, which makes you richer. So that's and I can stop there, but scarcity is what wealth looks for, because you need a foundation to keep that wealth stable. And then once you do that, everything falls against the scarcity. So the cost of a home, but also like the dollars, right? Because dollars are being produced. The math around dollars, you want to, like, the government talks about the inflation numbers, but those numbers are like, I don't want to go math terms, but those are like a basket of goods that they pick. It may not be a basket. It doesn't mean anything to you and me, right? Because I don't, like, if you looked in the inflation basket, me and you might go, we don't even spend on that kind of stuff. That's not what we spend on. My inflation rate and your inflation rate are different because it depends on what you spend your money on. So that's more like, you know, government stuff, politics stuff. Like, when you look at the real inflation, which is what I call, like, how much they devalue the money by, you know, that's like basically like how much money they print, you know, on average. And that number has been something like 7% a year for the last 50-100 years. So what that means is if your money is, your money has to earn at least 7% a year to not be diluted or not be decreased in value when the government prints the money, right? And so where I'm going with that is you have that number, and then you have the rich people who are going, okay, yeah, we see the money being decreased in value, so now I got to go find something to put it in that won't decrease in value. And when you do that, it sort of works backwards. You get the 7% a year sucked into your asset, because I'm going too deep into it, but
so does that make bitcoins different from other assets?
Basically, because the money is going to be called to the hardest asset, and so with Bitcoin is the hardest money. Mm-hmm. So once as people go through their learning curve and understand it, they're going to first be attracted by the returns, and then they're going to do their research, and they're going to realize, oh, this is the hardest money to produce. Then it sucks in all the wealth over time. So it eats up the money that would have normally went into gold. It eats up the money that would have normally went into, like, people typically used to buy rental properties. Like, rich people bought rental properties because if you keep the money in the bank, it decreases in value over time. So you don't want to do that. So you're like, but I can put it in real estate, right? There, you know, that appreciates because there's a limited supply of real estate. And so they bought rental properties. Well, now you got a money where you don't have to maintain a rental property. You don't got to deal with renters. If the world shuts down, you don't got to worry about not getting rent. You can put the money into Bitcoin and transfer that wealth across the world, like, easy. So if you want to leave the country, you don't got to liquidate all your properties. You can just take it with you on your USB key or in your head. You get to, you know, that's a whole conversation. But it's a more efficient way to store wealth. So the old school ways you don't have to do anymore. It's just now a learning curve, and everybody's going through the learning curve on their own.
You're listening to In Black America with Johnny O. Hanson Jr. We'll be back in just a moment.
Support comes from Austin Water. Residents and businesses can take steps now to prepare for the possibility of severe and freezing temperatures by having emergency supplies like water and insulation for pipes. More winter preparedness tips at austinwater.org.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O. Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Philip Washington Jr., CEO of Stonehill Wealth Management and host of Wealth Building Made Simple podcast. Now, when you talk about the learning curve, why is it, in your opinion, important for African Americans to begin looking at this new currency?
Yeah, so great question. So I talked earlier about the bees, right? Mm-hmm. This is a cool story. So we were, you know, back in the day, we were in Africa, and there was like these bees that were hard to produce because in the area that the island that it was on, these were just like rare bees, right? And so, we hadn't invented ships yet, so we couldn't like sell to different islands and get the other bees. This was on this island. This was a rare commodity, and since this was our community, we sort of just used those as money, right? Because it made sense, like, you know. So then the Europeans came with their ships, and they realized, oh man, this is how they trade for money, but we want to buy their resources. So let's do this. They hopped on the ship. They went to other islands. They grabbed a bunch of stuff. They manufactured the bees, and they came back, and they would purchase the thing with the bees because we had no concept of them going to islands and doing that. You know what I'm saying? Like, we had been on the island, so we didn't know that the bees were manufactured by them on a different island, right? So it took a while, but over time, they flooded our market with the bees. But they had, so it was like printing money, but they bought up all of our stuff with printed money. And we got real poor once market realized that, oh, wait, it's like a lot more money on the island than what there should be because it's no longer hard to manufacture because they got ships. So they had a leg up on us. It wasn't It wasn't superior intellect, right? It wasn't superior fighting skills, right? Because we did it in a peaceful way, commerce, right? The difference was they understood the money and they understood the economics of it. We didn't have as hard of a currency as we understood. So for black people, the thing that if we want economic freedom, then we got to understand, okay, if I want to not have my wealth stolen from me, I can't do what, you know, grandma's saying for money in the bank, because that's not actually safe. Like, rich people don't think money in the bank is safe. They think that's the riskiest place you can put your money over the long term, because they know that 7% a year is what they're devaluing the money at on average. So they're like, cool, I need to go buy a sports franchise, right? The Dallas Cowboys, right? It's a monopoly in the minds of a bunch of fans that don't really care if they win. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's a monopoly. So they want to own that. They want to own the real estate on that. They want to own real estate in economic centers like Dallas, New York, Paris, London, France, Japan. They want to own shares in Netflix, Apple, you know, companies that got monopolies, because those are hard to produce. And so they don't, they rich people want to own scarce things. And again, Bitcoin appeals to them because Bitcoin is the most scarce asset. You can produce more shares than Netflix, right? Dallas can become preferred place to live over New York or Los Angeles, right? So even though you can't produce more University Park real estate, you can get the billionaires from Hollywood to move to Dallas. You know what I mean? And that pushes up that, you know, and so that pushes up, you know, that price and reduces the price to folks that live in Hollywood relative to Dallas. But Bitcoin is only going to be 21 million. And so I give you another thing. Jay-Z and Jack Dorsey, who's the founder of Cash App, well, Square, which owns Cash App, they went and took something like 500 Bitcoin and started an incubator in Africa, because if you have unbanked people who really are not in the money system that's losing value every year now, and you teach them about money, but you teach them about money on the foundation of like what money is supposed to be, meaning money is not supposed to be devalued. Money is supposed to be stable. You shouldn't have people that should be able to devalue the money whenever they want to expand the government. That's just like, we accept it as truth because it's what we know. It doesn't, like, but we also used to accept that we need to go to the church to learn to read before the printing press. When the printing press came, it's like, oh, we can read on our own. People were like, well, you know, my priest said I shouldn't go read the book. That's the devil. Whatever. You go believe him. I'm going to read. You know what I'm saying? So it's just a matter of evolving our beliefs about like what money is, because, you know, the world has been grown up with money controlled by, you know, bankers.
Mr. Washington, does Bitcoin have a counterparty?
No, that's the cool part. There's no custodian, no counterparty, no CEO. Bitcoin is more like, think of Bitcoin more like America or the internet. Let's use America for example, right? So America, before America, the system for organizing societies, at least in that present time period, was like you had a king, right? The smartest, wealthiest people, you know, would run the country, and the peasants would just do what they said, right? Because they kept you protected. And then the Americans came, and they was like, hey, man, listen, like, the king is taxing us way too much, and I think that I'm smarter than the king. And so, like, why don't we go start this new thing, but so we can avoid centralized power? Let's create three branches of government, right? Let's give some checks and balances. Let's put this thing called the Constitution in place that keeps taking, you know, it's a protocol, basically. Put it in place so that if anybody ever gets too powerful and too, you know, too smart, whatever, the checks and balances will work it out, and this will do what it did. And so 300 years later, or however long it's been, we, you know, we still have the most free society, right? Everybody complains about America. They go, oh, America's crazy, America's this. And then I say, but listen, only in, like, I don't see in all the other countries, and I'm a black guy, all the other countries, they haven't had the free world, they haven't had a black president yet, and there ain't as many rich black people. It, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, we're ex-slaves And we got more rich black people in America than all these other woke countries in Europe. You know what I mean? They talk down to. And I'm not disrespecting Europe, but I'm like, the Europeans talk trash about Americans and how that we're just such a terrible, unruly place. But I'm like, man, but we got more rich black people. You know what I mean? And I can do upward mobility better in America because of the distributed, seemingly chaotic system, because, like, we get to vote and we got checks and balances. You know what I'm saying? And we got crazy people who can pursue crazy ideas if enough crazy people back them. And so that's why we attract all the capital. That's why we attract all the innovation. That's why we have an immigration problem. That's why everybody wants to trade with the dollar, because it's a non-centralized system is attractive to energy and money. And so Bitcoin is a system where there is no ruler, right? The system was set up. Nobody can change it. It's distributed power, right? Because anybody can run a node, anybody can check the system, right? Anybody can verify the system. And there's all these things put in place where a system was set up, and it was like, hey, if you guys want to join it, you can. It's the Wild Wild West, but we don't have any kings or rulers, right? And so that's attractive to money, because they're like, yes, please. I don't want any counterparties. I don't want any central points of failure. You know, I just want to be able to look at the system. It's transparent. I can see it. I can observe it. And if I want to move money off, I can whenever I want to. But I'm free. Yeah, freedom attracts money.
Is Bitcoin the only cryptocurrency?
So Bitcoin is the only cryptocurrency that is like that, where it's scarce and has freedom. The rest of them, the majority of them, more like stocks, where they have like leadership teams, you know. And the leadership team can sort of change things, and that'll be useful. But you know, Bitcoin is the most decentralized scarce system, and the other ones are sort of more like, if I had to describe it, more like stocks, right? You can invest in them, but you're really investing in a team. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so the team may be good, they may not be good. That's fine, but like, that's what they are, which is a different value proposition.
Now, when you look at purchasing Bitcoins, how do you go about it? Do you buy a whole coin, or you buy a part of a coin? Talk to us about how that process worked.
Most people don't buy a whole coin, because I think a coin right now is like 96 grand.
Okay.
So what most people do is they'll just, you can dollar cost average. You can put 50 bucks a month, 10 mm-hmm. bucks a week, you know, whatever you can do. To buy Bitcoin, because each Bitcoin is worth, or can be divided by like 100 million different units.
Okay.
So you basically can buy a super duper small amount, and you can buy it on like you can buy some on Cash App. These are not recommendations, but like, you can buy it as easy on Cash App. You can go to a crypto exchange like Coinbase. You can buy it through an ETF.
Philip Washington Jr., founder and CEO of Stonehill Wealth Management. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archives for Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm John L. Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh Public Affairs.
Hey, y'all, what's up? Happy Wednesday. It has been 37 days since Donald Trump took office, and a lot has been going on every single one of those 37 days. Yeah, And you could be feeling a lot of things about that, but more than anything, you might be feeling overwhelmed. But whatever you're feeling, I want you to know that you should never feel alone. So for the first 100 days, I'm going to be coming to you once a month with a general recap of how Americans are feeling, with polls and data provided by Navigator Research. So these posts will also be nonpartisan. I'm just going to give you a lay of the land. I always think it's important for you to be able to inform your own opinions and make your own judgment calls. And what better way to do that than discussing the relevant data? So without further ado, let's get into it. Hey, y'all, what's up? It's Friday. So I'm going to keep it black, but I'm going to keep it brief. I would like to interrupt your regularly scheduled programming from briefs about what's going on in the weekly news to give us an opportunity to do something we haven't done all February, and that's celebrate Black History Month. And if you know me, you know that I believe storytelling is essential to translating our stories across time. It is the lifeline of our culture. Griots, writers, poets, playwrights, screenwriters all have been artists, or what James Baldwin calls witnesses, tasked with bottling the essence of Black moments, big and small, and transmitting them into cultural artifacts. Historically, we've adopted several mediums to relate our messages to the rest of the world, but the most potent ones are the ones that can allow you to attach real people to real stories in real time. It's why I've got a whole segment of Parking Lot Pippin dedicated to Black film called The Drive-In, because Black film has been one of the most critical methods witnesses have been able to use to stake change in communities outside of our own. Some of these witnesses you may know as Oscar Michaud, America's first major Black film director. Melvin Van Peebles, a cornerstone in the Blaxploitation movement. Then you got Spike Lee, Julie Dash, John Singleton, Gina Prince-Bythewood, Jordan Peele, and so many more who have afforded us versions of our stories that don't only signify the heroism that's characteristic of our culture, but the humanity too. In my personal opinion, one of the most important and very recent shifts in our culture is disallowing the concepts of strength and resilience to eclipse the totality of who we are as everyday people. Because of the trauma that's so deeply ingrained in, that unfortunately goes hand in hand with Black history, strength and resilience have been held as the leading coping mechanisms for us to push forward and push through. But in times like these, it is so important that we are reminded that we have always been full and complete people, that our worth and our value is not always tied to how much we can push back, but also on how much we can just be. When it comes to genres, biopics and historical retellings and adaptations are my personal favorite. And I've recently seen a couple like Unstoppable starring Jarrell Jerome and Sing Sing starring Colvin Domingo on Prime Video. And these two, like many others, offer much more than a glimpse of heroism. They offer the picture of duality necessary to humanize us to the world. Everyday representation like this is necessary for people from all walks of life to connect across boundaries, neighborhoods, belief systems, and more. Okay, well, hold, please. Now, me personally, I am watching Genius Season 4 on Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. And now that I think about it, I gotta go back and watch the Aretha Season 3, just to watch Cynthia Erivo sing down again. But you can also watch films from those witnesses and directors I was telling you about before as well, and many more titles this month on Prime Video. So gather the family, get you some popcorn, and try to escape for just a moment. Happy Black History Month.
I want to bring in my pals, Rachel Maddow, Nicole Wallace, and Lawrence O'Donnell. It's exactly like the specials, except I can't ask Maddow for cocktail tips when she's trying to write 8,000 words of copy. And I'm like, well, can't you just tell me one thing about the cocktails? No, I have to write this copy. Thank you all for being here. Let's talk about this, because I wanted you guys to be here with me, because you are my comrades in arms in covering this insane moment that we're in when it comes to what is happening in our country. I want to start with you, Rachel. I would love for you to give our audience just your take, your tips. What do you think people can be doing right now that's effective?
Well, first I want to say that I love you, Joy.
I love you.
And that I am bereft that the readout is ending. I just can't even, I sort of can't get beyond that. So I want to say that, but that is also part of what I think I have to say to the country about this moment, which is find people who you respect and trust and love and make common cause with them and help yourself by learning from them and help them by standing up for them. And I think we have tried to do that. And I think that in important ways we have failed, but I think it's still the right thing to try to do. And so whether that means, joining something locally, or whether that means making some sort of more unofficial common cause with the people in your life who you respect and who you think are people you can depend on, like I feel about you, you gotta join forces. None of us can do this alone. And being atomized and dislocated and picked off one by one is a strategy of the other side, and we need to stick together.
Indeed. And when you're hearing Rachel say that, know that no one fights for us harder in this company than Rachel Maddow. And when I tell you she is our fearless leader, we mean it. And she is our super friend. We love her so much. And let me go to speaking of super friends, when y'all watch on the special, the person that says exactly what I was going to say, making me have to think of a whole different thing to say, because she thinks she's like so brilliant, but I'm like, I'm just literally so in awe of just your history, your ability, your political acumen. Nicole Wallace, my good sister, tell me what you, your brilliant self, believe people can do.
Well, I'm going to break the rules the way Rachel broke the rules and tell you that I love you. That the happiest times I've had, not just at MSNBC, but ever being on television, have been sitting next to the two of you. No offense, Lawrence. We love having you there, too.
We love Lawrence.
And that I think that I thought that things like that on TV couldn't be real, but that the friendships that have sustained me have been with both of you. And I am, you know, it's like losing a limb, the thought of doing those nights without you. Your strength and your fearlessness is the answer to the question I think you're getting at with both of us. And I think that my reaction to the end of the readout and your departure is despair. And the only thing that chips away at that for me is that despair is the autocrat's tool. It's their most effective weapon. It costs nothing. It's easy to deploy. It's contagious. And then it puts in motion all the actions they want: hopelessness, isolation, exasperation, giving up.
Yeah.
And so the only reason I will not wallow in what I feel about you leaving is because I think that's what they want. And so I don't think there can be artificial joy and gaslighting about sort of breaking up the pro-democracy side. I think it has to be, you know, I think we have to be real with ourselves and with each other. But I do think I'm so intrigued and sort of I feel the stirrings in everything you've been covering tonight. You know, the answer to this moment is not going to come from a perfect ad being cut by a brilliant ad maker and put on the air that's for right. the perfect candidate that comes out of a lab. It's just that's not how we're going to save ourselves. And I think waiting for someone to save us is kind of how we got here. We have to save ourselves. We as a country yeah. have to decide that Elon Musk getting, you know, I mean, I don't even know what the word is. He's already the richest person in the world, you know, richer than the richest person, you know, to ever exist. I don't even know what the goal is. But I think that turning this over to the country and saying, you may think this is what you wanted, but this is not who we are.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. And I think people are getting there. And Lawrence, I want to bring you in because, and again, I keep going back to the special because, like, literally, it's like a little party. We're like a girl group, but we let one guy or two hang around. Hayes gets to hang around, but we love our Lawrence. Lawrence is literally the guy that we're all sitting there waiting. What in the world is Lawrence going to say? Because we're going to be like, that's it. We got it. We understand it. So do that for us now, Lawrence. Just solve all of these democracy problems for us now. 3, 2, 1, go.
this is the greatest honor lineup I've ever been in. So let me just start with that. An honor to be in this lineup. And Joy, I'm going to skip the love stuff because we did that on Saturday.
It's true.
You know, I put it in writing in that first text when I said yes. I love you. Okay, so you have that. And writing's forever, so you have it.
Y'all don't realize we literally text and call each other. Like, it's really wild. But anyway, please, Lawrence, please continue.
So I want to turn to this wonderful book by Joanne Reed.
Oh, no.
Medgar and Murley. No, seriously, this is important, and it's to the answer of what we're talking about here. Because, you know, right in the middle of it, on page 194, there is this. This is the decisive battleground for America. Now, that really feels like something someone said 5 minutes ago or any time in this year. That's 1964. That's a 24-year-old guy named Michael Schwerner who is going to be murdered that year after he says that, because he has decided in 1964 that what he's going to do is leave the safety of his home in the North and go to Mississippi, the most dangerous place in America, and go down there as a civil rights worker trying to help people register to vote. That was his choice. There were other people who couldn't do that. people his age who never leaving their neighborhoods or their towns in the North and elsewhere around the country, tried to fight the same fight, tried to do what they could do. There were people who decided that what they would do is vote, that they were on the side of the righteous, but all they could do is vote. But every one of those people made some kind of decision
right.
in the face of something that was hopeless. It looked hopeless in 1964. It looked in 1964 that if you think you're going to work to get black people the right to vote in Mississippi, you are going to be dead and no one's going to get the right to vote. And in the end, he won. He won in death. He won from the grave. And that choice is there for everybody all the time. And there's another thing that comes to mind, Joy, and I'll shut up, and that is Walter Lippmann, when he went to his 30th class, Harvard class anniversary, which I know is a distant thing for you. Your Harvard class, your 30th reunion isn't coming for a long time. But Lippmann said to his Harvard class in 1940, you know, before the United States is into World War II, but World War II is underway, that they now had no choice. There was no choice. They couldn't take anything for granted. They had to join this fight against fascism. They had to join it because there was no way you could sit back and choose to do nothing. He didn't tell them what to do. He didn't say you should join the army or anything. He just said, you know, you absolutely must now be committed with every bit of strength you have. Again, against something that seemed hopeless. I mean, Germany was just raging across Europe then. Mm-hmm. It looks like there was going to be a winner and it was going to be Hitler. And so these dark hours have demanded things of people that they have risen to in the past. And there's no reason why people can't find their own spot. You know, Michael Schwerner didn't join a political campaign. He didn't need a leader to tell him what to do. He just did it. He just got on that bus and he went to Mississippi. He just did it. And everyone can just do it.
Yeah. Amen. And Rachel, I mean, that is so powerful because, you know, I like to steal good ideas and I give people credit for them. But you're the one who said history is here to help. I mean, it just actually is, you know, and you and I are both obsessed with the 1920s and 30s. I'm very obsessed with them. And the 20s, especially now, because it feels very resonant to today. But I think part of the thing of history is it kind of makes people feel a little dejected because we keep repeating it. And so I think the question is, what is the thing that puts a pin in history so that we don't? So I wonder how we use that history, that brilliant history we just heard from Lawrence, but not let that make us feel like, what's the point? Because we're just going to do it again.
Well, it cuts both ways, right? Because the severity of what our predecessors have been up against in the past is can be disheartening because you can think, like, why does this stuff keep coming back? Why do we never defeat these things? But the other way to look at it is to think, wow, our predecessors have a lot to teach us about how to defeat these things, about how to defeat, you know, one of the things that you and I have talked about a lot in the past year or two, Joy, is the way that we defeated the fascist movement here
That's right.
in the United States that wanted us not only not to join World War II, but if we were going to join on the side of the Nazis. We've talked a lot, you and I, especially around your book, Medgar and Murley, we've talked about the strategy and the human strength that it took to build a movement to defeat segregationism. And that mm-hmm. itself was a movement that was a minority movement that was fascistic in nature and that absolutely succeeded in ruling whole parts of the country until it was defeated by an equal by a larger and smarter movement that took it down. The people who went before us in this country who have defeated forces that were a lot more impressive than what we're up against right now have stories to tell us about what to do. And that's why you are interested in history. That's why we've all been covering so much history on all of our shows. It's not just because the bad guys recur. It's because yeah. the good guys who are never as famous as the
That's
bad
right.
guys.
Amen.
The good guys, they have stories to tell us about what to do. And we need to stay loud. We need to stay united. We need to protect the press. We need to protect the institutions that we've still got as they are under assault right now. But it starts with joining something. It starts with mm-hmm. finding people who you believe in, who inspire you, and who you love and trust. And that can be your colleagues at work, like we have. It can be your local Indivisible group. It can be your local book club. It can be anything. But now is not the time to be alone and scrolling on your phone. or complaining on social media. Now is the time to join something in real life.
We're a multiple ways thinking person. I don't know too many people that have one job. I don't. Most of the people I know are juggling because they recognize, particularly in entertainment, and this is why, you know, with all of the firings, I'm like, we're still fighting for somebody to be on a white station that doesn't, what are we doing? They keep doing this. Why are we rallying to keep somebody on something that is not serving us anyway? Why not Roland? Bring her on the, like, build that. Build Roland's thing. Like, this should not be, we're gonna rally. If y'all can get that much energy and have a phone call, you can put that energy into building out Black Star Network. I'm just saying. They already have the infrastructure. They already got the studios. Let's build that out. Bring all those people there and bring that money with you and the advertising dollars and all that. If it's that important that we have these voices, they got the same access to the media, even more so because YouTube actually reaches 1 billion. Can we flood the airwaves with Black excellence and stop worrying about these people who don't care a damn about you? They're literally marionetting Black people, using them as puppets to provide coverage for their nonsense. And they have not served us, these cable outlets. I'm pivoting a little bit. Not served us at all. They're the reason primarily that we have this cretin in office, because they gave him $1 billion worth of free advertising and never checked him. That's your job, media, checking the lies. You didn't. So now we're here. I'm not fighting for anything, any of that. I will play Joanne Reed's final words. Sasha opened up her show last night. Let's play it.
We begin tonight with what I think is the question. When you are in the midst of a crisis, and specifically a crisis of democracy, how do you resist? When fascism isn't just coming, it's already here. So what, if anything, can you do about it? Well, for one thing, you can try to learn from history, from what people in this situation in countries around the world and in America have done before. As my friend Rachel Maddow always says, history is here to help. America hasn't always been a free country for everyone, and we've had resistance movements from day one, from enslaved people fighting their captivity. Shout out to Harriet Tubman, who was a 92%er before 92%ing was cool. And even taking up arms during the Civil War, to the women's movement and the workers' rights movement and the Stonewall gay rights movement. They've all been versions of the fight to make this a free country for everyone and to have a true multiracial democracy. And that is history's most important lesson, right? That the most important thing, the first rule, is to fight back, to never stop resisting. Do not obey in advance, as Tim Snyder put it. Do not take the knee, to throw in a Game of Thrones reference. Even if it's scary or uncomfortable or inconvenient, just keep saying no, or finding creative ways to say no in small ways and large. Medgar Evers said, do not shop where they will not employ you. Mm. Dr. King championed the Montgomery bus boycotts to become the leader of the civil rights movement. The labor rights movement shut down factories and hobbled industries to win the 40-hour work week that you enjoy right now, and more recently to ensure the right of workers to work from home during COVID. People have marched against the Vietnam War and the war in Iraq and against the decimation of Gaza using our tax dollars. You don't always win every battle, but the whole thing is about resisting.
Yes. Thank you for that. Joanne Reed, final show last night. Yeah, we refuse. We resist. We show up for each other. Don't shop where they won't employ you. Yes, yes. This is the, and unfortunately, history rhymes. So this looks very familiar to some of our grandparents. But we're going to show up in the midst of this crisis. Yeah, how do we resist?
Hey, I was up. It has been 37 days since Donald Trump took office, and a lot has been going on every single one of those 37 days. Yeah, and you could be feeling a lot of things about that, but more than anything, you might be feeling overwhelmed. But whatever you're feeling, I want you to know that you should never feel alone. So for the first 100 days, I'm going to be coming to you once a month with a general recap of how Americans are feeling, with polls and data provided by Navigator Research. So these posts will also be nonpartisan. I'm just going to give you a lay of the land. I always think it's important for you to be able to inform your own opinions and make your own judgment calls. And what better way to do that than discussing the relevant data? So without further ado, let's get into it. Need my notes. So as we know, it is tax season. Yeah, and we've heard a lot of things, whether it's about Donald Trump trying to get rid of the IRS and create an ERS, whatever that means. But more than anything, what we've heard from the White House is messaging that we'll provide more tax cuts to the rich and create cuts to programs that our taxes would typically fund that would benefit the middle and lower classes. Here's what Americans are saying. Trump's alignment with tech CEOs is concerning. Most people, 90%, want tax cuts for the middle class instead. 69% of Americans believe tech CEOs are influencing Trump's administration, and it's seen across all racial groups, 68% in white folks, 66% black, 76% Hispanic, AAPI 77%, so it's not even that. 41% of Americans think Trump will help his billionaire friends get richer instead of helping the middle class, and 80% of Americans say CEOs, billionaires, and foreign investors should not get tax cuts. And speaking of his allegiance to tech billionaires, Elon Musk, his numbers are also dipping as far as favorability. As I'm sure you know, once Trump was put in office, he gave Elon Musk a new department, a Department of General Efficiency, to which he was able to access Americans' private information, our Social Security, the Department of Education, Department of Treasury, and since has laid off several federal employees. And a number of federal programs, once again, have been taking funding cuts. And while he might have landed at a 47% in unfavorability in October of 2024, he's now at 53%, and that might seem like a big drop, but generally Americans do not want tech billionaires calling shots and meddling in policy, period. Now, with all that said, basically Americans are feeling that Trump is focused on himself, doing what's best for himself. 53% of Americans feel that way. A lot of Americans feel like he's just bringing corruption to D.C., that whole the January 6th pardon. 48% of Americans do not like that or feel negatively about that. 44% of Americans feel negatively about the funding freeze. My biggest takeaway from all these numbers is that even though the election results would lead one to believe that the majority of Americans feel one way, as time passes for sure, discontent is brewing across Americans, regardless of race, class, gender, socioeconomic status, or any walk of life. So, yeah, we'll check back in next month. And if you feel like these numbers were helpful, please visit Navigator's Instagram and their website to see what poll information they have available to you now. Thank you.
You're not acting grateful enough. You're not being thankful. Donald Trump, to the leader of Ukraine. Joining our ongoing coverage, former United States Ambassador to the United Nations, former National Security Advisor to President Obama, Ambassador Susan Rice is here. Ambassador, your reaction.
Well, Nicole, obviously it's a very sad day and an embarrassment for the United States on the world stage. But let's step back and analyze what's happened here. I think there's no question that this was a setup. You heard Donald Trump say at the end of that clip you played, this is great television. This was a setup. Volodymyr Zelensky was compelled to agree to a horrible deal that would have sent Ukraine's minerals to the United States without any concrete security guarantees. And yet, because he was trying to improve a relationship with Donald Trump, he came to Washington, he came to the Oval Office, and sat down for a meeting, hat in hand. And soon after he got there, the vice president of the United States lit into him and started a confrontation. Now, I've been in countless Oval Office meetings with heads of state, presidents and vice presidents, as national security advisor, as UN ambassador, and in other roles. I can tell you that the vice president or the secretary of state or anybody else, they don't jump in, hijack a conversation without the express blessing of the president of the United States. So J.D. Vance did that deliberately. Donald Trump knew what he was going to do. And I think, as he said at the end, because he can't, you know, help himself, this was a setup for the cameras. It was a play to his base. But above all, it was a play to Vladimir Putin to show fealty to Vladimir Putin and to try to humiliate Zelensky. But Zelensky didn't play along with the script because Zelensky's got dignity and guts, and Zelensky has people that he democratically represents. And as a result, he couldn't sit there in silence as lies were being told about how the war was started, whose responsibility it was, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And he tried to explain what is in fact the case. To suggest that he was not thankful, I can't count the number of times that Zelensky has thanked the American people, the American government, the President of the United States for the critical support that we've provided. It's not about gratitude. It was an effort to humiliate him, to scuttle the U.S.-Ukraine relationship so that Trump no longer feels any obligation to provide support and to hand U.S. interests and Ukraine and potentially Europe to Putin on a silver platter.
Why?
That's a great question.
Susan, we're gonna unfreeze you. I want to play some more of the president in the Oval Office if we have more of that. We're trying to Ambassador, you're unfrozen.
I hope so.
I say why, and I'll add this: Trump had so much to say about everything he and Putin had been through together. It was like a dictator's version of "We Can Do Hard Things." If you're familiar with that podcast, it was insane.
Yeah, Nicole, I think we have to understand that what happened today is really a piece of a larger puzzle. We've seen this building, frankly, since before Trump returned to office. But literally so much of what he has done in his first 5 weeks in office have been to the benefit of Russia and China. So let's review the bidding. You know, threatening our ally, Denmark and Greenland. You know, starting a trade war with our closest allies and partners, trying to, you know, create a conflict with Canada and trying to pretend to relegate it to the 51st state. Vance going to Munich and basically trying to blow up the NATO alliance. Pulling the United States Agency for International Development 100% off the map and retreating. Proposing to cut 8% a year from the Department of Defense and literally dismantling the federal government and eviscerating it. That is not in any way, shape, or form in the national security interests of the United States. We are not only alone and alienated from our closest allies in Europe and Asia, as we heard from Turnbull, but worse, we have aligned ourselves completely with Russia, who is aligned with China, North Korea, and Iran. So in 5 weeks, we flipped the script, and we are dangerously isolated and cast our lot with adversaries who truly do not have our interests at heart.
I mean, Andrew Nastios, who was the head of USAID for George W. Bush, was on the program and made the argument that USAID keeps us safe from... It kept us safe from another 9/11 in the years after 9/11 because by stemming catastrophe and human suffering, you also counter extremism in some of the most brutal and hostile corners of the globe. That aid isn't just philanthropic, which seems to be Donald Trump's misunderstanding of it, that aid is one of our most mighty soft power tools, not just for ending human suffering, but for keeping us safe here. Another person described this as the worst 24 hours in modern American history, that we dismantle programs to spare children from dying of malaria and measles, mumps, preventable deaths and diseases, and we dismantle the World Alliance. What is Trump's end game if you're an adversary or an ally looking at everything he's doing?
I think his end game is to undermine the security and stability of the United States. And that brings us back to the question that you asked earlier. Why? There's no other way to look at this in sum, Nicole, than to see that this is a deliberate and comprehensive weakening of the United States in very short order, from a security point of view, from an economic point of view, from a diplomatic point of view, all to the benefit of our principal adversaries, Russia primarily, and China. And so I think the sooner the American people understand what this is about, what this is at what's at stake, the clearer we can be. Now, Vladimir Putin is not popular in the United States. 80% of Americans understand him to be the vicious, cruel dictator that he is. But I'd love to hear more than one Republican in Congress.
Hi, you are listening to the Jazz Corner here on WRCT Pittsburgh and WRCT.org.